Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. Late on the night of July 13, 1966, 8 of 9 student nurses were brutally murdered in their townhouse in Chicago. The 8 horrific murders were attributed to Richard Speck, a 24-year-old unemployed seaman with a long rap sheet. One nurse survived by hiding under a bed. She was the crux of the prosecution's case, a slam dunk that brought in a guilty verdict after only 47 minutes of jury deliberation. In the decades that followed, no one studied all the inconsistencies between the police reports, the witness testimony, the FBI files, the physical evidence, the autopsy findings, the newspaper articles, and trial testimony. Well, not until now. Author B.D. Salerno spent over 3 years studying sources and reference materials never before investigated, deconstructing the historical narrative that served as the official story of the crime. Her findings are nothing less than astounding. Those shocking findings in Beattie's highly acclaimed book, Richard Speck and the 8 Nurses, Deconstructing a Mass Murder. Beattie has worked with investigators on a number of cold cases and writes extensively about famous crimes and missing persons. She's been with us before to talk about her other books, and she's back with us on This Week in America, B.D. Salerno, author of Richard Speck and the 8 Nurses. B.D., welcome to the program. A pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Rick. It's so great to be back.
What a remarkable job you've done with this, receiving rave reviews, people reading it saying, I thought it was an open and shut case. Now I have my doubts as well. Talk about what prompted you to begin this 3-year search. What fascinated you so much and got you involved in this to the point where you didn't feel comfortable with what you were reading and you did your own research?
Well, it started on a summer day in July of 1966. I was going to be a junior in high school, and I flipped open the paper that morning and saw the headlines, 8 student nurses slain. And I was drawn right into the story with complete horror. I had never heard anything so awful. And it struck a chord in me because these young women were just a few years older than me, and they were doing things that I was planning to do. They were involved with their education. They were setting out on their career course. And of course, I was getting ready to think about applying for colleges. So it really hurt me to think that somebody would take these 8 lovely young women and just brutally murder them for no apparent reason at all. And the subsequent news coverage was just ghastly. And I read everything at the time. It was so upsetting. It was kind of like the ending of the innocence of youth. You know, the world really is around you. It stayed with me. And as a true crime fan, it was the one crime that stood out in my mind when I would go on to research and learn about other crimes. It was always in the back of my mind that there were so many unanswered questions, namely the stories about how the nurses did not scream. They didn't try to run away, even though studying the layout of the townhouse they lived in, there were ample opportunities to escape. And it just didn't make sense. And I couldn't imagine the surviving nurse doing what she claimed she did in order to avoid being murdered. And subsequent to that, she was the star witness. People asked these questions, but it was the 60s. We trusted our authorities. When he was convicted and
different time, yes.
That was the end of it. And yet questions remained in people's minds, especially mine. And so, okay, I am fortunate to go through and have my career and my further education. But at a certain point, came the pandemic in 2020, and I've been looking around for something to do. I had been doing some research in my astrology work, and I thought, well, there's that mass murder that always bothered me. I think I'm going to look at that. And as I started to study the literature on it, it still raised the same questions. It was hard to believe that no one resisted this man. There were 8 women against one man, Richard Speck, supposedly, who was also supposedly drunk and high on drugs. Now, that's quite a feat to overcome 9 healthy, strong young women, many of whom were athletic. Some of them were swimmers. They played volleyball. They played softball. They were in great physical shape, and they were strong young women. So I immediately started to look into it. And the more I got into it, the fewer questions I could resolve. And I had no intention of writing a book. I was just trying to satisfy my curiosity. But at a certain point, I thought, I followed true crime a lot in the media and on the internet. And I started to think, what would the investigators do? Where would they start to look if they really wanted to figure this out? So I filed my very first FOIA request with the Chicago Police Department. And then I looked through the book to see all the authorities who were involved in this crime, this investigation. And then I filed a FOIA request with the FBI and with the Coast Guard, because Richard Speck had just joined the Coast Guard prior to the murders. I requisitioned the autopsy reports from the Chicago Medical Examiner's office because I just wanted to get as close to the nitty-gritty as I possibly could to figure out what happened. I made drawings of the interior layout of the house, first and second floor, the surrounding neighborhood. I mean, I went all in to just try and.
Yes, exactly.
And by the time I start to unravel a few pieces, I also was very lucky to come across the trial transcript of the surviving witness. She was the state's star witness, and I believe she single-handedly got Richard Speck convicted with her testimony. And I read that, and I started to compare the trial testimony with her original police statements, and they didn't jive. And then some weeks later, so I made notations in the trial transcripts in all the, between the lines. I was making notations. No, this is what she said to the police. This is what she said to the detectives. And then when the FBI files came in a few months later, I was completely horrified because they reversed almost everything that was told in the original police statements. And so I kind of had a dilemma on my hands. I had never attempted this kind of an investigation. I'm not an investigator or a lawyer or a law enforcement. I'm just a person with common sense and critical thinking trying to piece together a very complex crime. But I just sat down and took everything apart and tried to line it up and match it. Nothing matched and nothing lined up. At that point, I thought, I have to write this. There's something really wrong with this case. I was familiar with writing books. I had written two other books prior to this, as you know, that we already talked about. And I said, I have to write this. This is a case that just does not make sense. And I do not believe Richard Speck was guilty of these murders for many reasons. And it was an enormous undertaking, but I just sat at my desk. As I said, it was pandemic. I wasn't going anywhere anyway. Just started to
Yes.
put pieces together. I put things in order. I was a paralegal in my career, so I was accustomed to managing stacks of documents.
You laid it out so well. We follow exactly. Sometimes you read true crime and they jump all over the place. You take us step by step and we fully understand. The book, by the way, is Richard Speck and the Eight Nurses, Deconstructing a Mass Murder. The book is available wherever books are sold, and by Amazon, of course, Barnes and Noble. The author is B.D. Salerno. That's Salerno. Her website is strangebuttruecrime.com. All of this on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. It's a fascinating read. Once you start, she really takes you quickly where of all of the inconsistencies, and there are so many. I mentioned some just briefly in the beginning, sort of failure on everybody's part. You mentioned the knife and the fingerprints, two areas of inconsistencies that bothered you as you were researching that. Talk about the knife and the fingerprints and why that led you to really having serious doubts as to whether or not Richard Speck was guilty.
Be glad to. First of all, it's a common notion in the true crime literature that a very large knife was used, like a hunting knife was used to commit the crimes. This hunting knife has been represented in video documentaries about the crime. That's wrong. No weapon was found. There was no knife found. So they were without a weapon. And law enforcement had spun a number of rumors about what they thought happened. One was that Richard Speck had to go over the Calumet River to go back to his hotel room after he committed the murders. And they surmised that he threw the knife into the Calumet River. Now, they went into the river and dove with a magnet, and they retrieved a folding knife, which is the kind of knife you use. It was not like a hunting knife. It was a folding knife. It's the kind you would pick apart with your fingernail, and it was maybe a 2.5-inch long blade, and then a secondary blade that was maybe 2.25 inches long. And so they pulled that up, and they said, this is the knife. It has the tip broken off, and that happened when he pried the screen off the window. He broke the tip off the knife. This is the knife, but it wouldn't stand up to scrutiny, and they could not submit it into evidence. They could not definitively connect it to Richard Speck. Now, I'm going to fast forward to the early 90s when the prosecutor, William J. Martin, wrote a best-selling book about the case, and in which he publishes a picture, a photograph of the knife that was withdrawn from the Calumet River. That knife is a folding knife, the way I described it. However, there's no tip broken off. And that missed everybody's attention. And I thought, wait a minute, they said the tip was broken off when Richard Speck jimmied the screen off the window to break in. This knife is intact. The second issue I had with this knife is that it was 2.75 inch long, and a couple of the nurses had 4-inch deep stab wounds. So it wasn't possible to have been made with this knife. And these are things that were bandied about and just put into the public knowledge without anybody really questioning it. And ironically, I happen to have a folding knife, the exact same dimensions of the one they found, because they were very commonly made. And I put a picture of my knife in my book. It was like a man like Richard Speck, who was a very tall, gangly man, had very long fingers. He had no cuts or injuries on his arms or fingers. And to have wielded a knife with only a 2.75-inch blade, it would have slipped while it got wet with blood. It could have dropped it. It could have folded over and cut his fingers. And he had no injuries of any kind, indicating that he would have used such a knife. Plus the fact that the knife was not capable of making some of the wounds in the first place. So that was, as it turned out, they had no knife as a weapon. They didn't need it. They had the strength of the star witness's testimony, which, as I point out in the book, was extremely flawed and contradictory.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think she provided a false narrative? Was she trying to cover up for somebody?
Yeah, I believe that a cover-up was involved, and it may have involved threats to her and or her family. I don't really know about that. That's something I wasn't able to get that level of specific information from what I could gather in my research. But I think that I do not believe the crime could have taken place the way she narrated it. And I think maybe someone took her aside and said, listen, you're going to tell this story or else. I don't know. Possibly she was threatened. She definitely knew more than what was ever revealed. And some of the accounts that she made of the goings-on during the night, which she described in unbelievable detail, incredible detail as to every single thing that happened throughout the course of the night, does not come off as realistic. And so I examined those details and also what was said in the police reports that she initially gave. And they just did not gel. It's like, wait a minute, you said that this nurse was tied up, but she was found not tied up. Several of them were not really tied up. She told the police they were all tied up. And then she went and corrected it. No, they weren't. And then in the police report, the ones that she said were tied up, it said the feet are not bound or the hands are not bound. And the most egregious of these was that one of the nurses, who was a friend of hers, a young Filipina nurse, was bound at the hands and feet, the hands behind her back. And she testified specifically, yes, her hands were tied when Richard Speck removed her from the room. And unfortunately, they were all killed in other rooms outside of where they were being held as a group. And yes, she was bound. She was tied. Well, this nurse was found to have pulled a short black hair and some particles of skin from the face or head of the attacker. So she's holding it between her fingers, and there's documentation of this. Short black hair found between the thumb and forefinger. If your hands are tied behind your back, you can't do that.
Exactly.
You know, so right there she testified, oh, no, her hands were tied behind her back. No, her hands were not tied, which leads me to question, what else was wrong? What else was not jiving with what she said? And as I progressed and looked back at the police report and then at the trial transcript, I was like, oh, no, this doesn't even match. No one caught that. The defense attorney did not do his job. I'm not a lawyer, you know, but I can see enough to know that he did not do his job. He could have attacked many stages of her testimony, and he did not, because I believe the whole thing was a setup to frame Richard Speck for some other nefarious things that were actually going on.
Now, in the book is Richard Speck and the Eight Nurses. Our guest is B.D. Salerno, S-A-L-E-R-N-O. I want to let you know so you can get information and get a copy of the book. Her website, strangebuttruecrime.com. A lot of great information there as well. Book available at Amazon, the usual places. Didn't mean to interrupt there. Finish that thought, please.
Oh, no worries. Just to jump quickly to the fingerprints. They did not have Richard Speck's fingerprints on file in Chicago because they did not have the APHIS system at that time, which is a nationwide database of fingerprints. They had to get the fingerprints from Washington, D.C. They were very stressed out about that delay because they were in the process of collecting prints from the house. And so they had to have the prints flown in from D.C. to Chicago. There happened to be an airline strike at that time, which made it even harder to get them. But they managed to finally fly in and get a private plane to fly the prints to Chicago. That took a number of hours. In the meantime, the crime lab technicians went to Richard Speck's hotel room and seized his prints off of a beer can. They brought the prints back in the middle of the afternoon, and I believe, for the purpose of checking those prints against what they had on file. And then when they got the chain of custody prints that matched, they would be able to say, yes, these are the prints of Richard Speck. They gel with what we found on the beer can. What stuck out to me was that was a matter of about 7 hours between receipt of the beer can fingerprints and what they let the FBI know at the end of the 7 hours was, we don't have a match here. Now, that's significant. If they got the beer can prints in the middle of the afternoon and compared them to the prints they located in the house, they should have made a match by 7 hours.
Yes.
They should have been a match. But at 9:45 that night, I have in my possession a telefax that went to D.C. from the Chicago FBI agent saying, we still don't have a match. That's telling me the prints on the beer can, which belonged to Richard Speck, were not located in the townhouse. Then they lifted those prints, but by the next morning, voila, they found 3 prints on the door of the bedroom where he held the nurses captive. And they were very blurry, very smudged. They were in odd places. One print was only 16 inches off the floor. Richard Speck would have had to be sitting on the floor to make that fingerprint.
Yes.
Which is ridiculous. Just the whole thing looked like the prints had been planted. And they were not clear prints, as I said. What one specialist made out was they could have been the prints of 2 of the nurses because they bore certain similarities. Prints have classifications and they get more and more and more specific. But the general classification was they could have belonged to 2 of the nurses. So in my mind, the prints were indefinite and they weren't a solid enough piece of evidence to hang the hat on of a conviction.
It's just amazing.
They had the direct evidence. They had prints. They had direct eyewitness testimony. And they had also some T-shirts that they claim he left at the house, which is inconclusive. But they said they were his T-shirts. So they were his T-shirts, in other words. But all of those went on paper, that looks like a slam dunk. Upon closer scrutiny, it's anything but.
That's what's amazing is you read this story, you begin to think this was, it took 47 minutes. It couldn't be much quicker. Something that this significant usually takes, the jury takes a little while to deliberate. They returned basically right away. As soon as the door was shut in the jury room, the door is open and they come back with a verdict. A couple minutes left. Something else that's really interesting here, that your discovery about illicit activities in the nurses training hospital. And if you wonder, as you read that, did this have any impact on the murders? What are your thoughts?
I think it definitely had an impact. I think the hospital was the only common denominator that would have put the nurses at risk as witnesses to something nefarious that was going on. Now, I speculate on the reason in my book, and I make it clear that it's a speculation because I can't prove it. But I did find evidence to the effect that certain doctors at the hospital were performing illegal sterilizations on minority women. And I'm saying I have evidence to that because there are lawsuits that were filed against illicit sterilizations of tubal ligations of women who went in for routine gynecological procedures, came out, and years later, finding that they were no longer fertile, they sought the advice of specialists who told them, well, your tubes have been tied, you can't conceive a child. They didn't even know that their tubes had been tied. And they traced it back to when they had gone to the hospital for, as I said, routine gynecological procedures. So I thought, oh, that's a big one, because in Illinois, that was illegal. It was legal in certain states to perform sterilizations of what they considered undesirable, you know, citizens, like criminals, the mentally ill, and they put all lumped people into this category where they were, you know, eligible for sterilization. This was actually legal in the United States in the 1920s and 30s. It never passed in Illinois. But at that hospital, they didn't get that memo. They were doing that, and I also think there could have been something else. It could have been drug smuggling. A lot of things can happen at a hospital when there's not a lot of supervision. And there wasn't, because the doctors were all contractors. They weren't even employed by the hospital.
Yes. Boy, there was so much there. The book is such a fascinating read, and you're not going to sit down and think, okay, I've got a half hour, I'm going to start it. You're going to be there and finish the book, because once you get going, you want to see where the case goes. Richard Speck and the Eight Nurses, Deconstructing a Mass Murder. Let me just ask you in conclusion here, why do you think this happened? Was it a plot to cover up something specifically, or was there so much pressure? And this, again, was a different era. This was the 1960s. The politicians were taking heat because this happened. These young ladies just starting off their careers were mass murdered. You had the pressure of the media, the pressure on the police department. Was it a rush to judgment, or was it more nefarious than that?
I vote for more nefarious, hands down. I think there were some things going on that they could not afford. I think one or two nurses were in the know, but they lived together. They did everything together as students, and the perpetrators couldn't run the risk of someone having said something to one of their housemates. So I felt that it was a concerted effort to conceal something. I believe, knowing what I learned about the character of some of these nurses, that they wouldn't have stood for what they would have witnessed. They wouldn't have stood for an illegal tubal ligation. They wouldn't have wanted to perform it. And so I think someone might have gotten upset and threatened to blow the whistle. And we know what happens to whistleblowers when something very serious is at stake, like the reputation of a hospital.
Yes.
The millions of dollars of grant that the hospital was getting at the time would have been under threat. So I really think it was a cover-up, and it was done on an expert scale, as I said, slam dunk. No one ever looks at this case because it's a closed case. And Richard Speck is dead, and most of the participants are dead. So that's why I felt it incumbent upon me to write the book, because I thought, this has got to be known. There were so many things in the 1960s that were covered up. We had Kennedy, we had RFK, we had Martin Luther King. And I thought, you know, this is just another one of a long list of fall guys that Richard Speck played the part of. So that gave me the impetus to put the book together. And I hope people enjoy reading it, get something out of it, and maybe learn something from it for when things like this happen again at least we have an inside track on trying to understand what really goes on behind the scenes.
Well, it's laid out so well. Again, it's not a rush to judgment on the author's part. It's all laid out, and you get to the same conclusions that VD did as you follow all the evidence as she lays it out. And it's interesting. That was a totally different time for whistleblowers. I don't think there were protections of any kind out there. You just didn't do that. There were ramifications. Now, at least, there are some laws in place to attempt to protect them. So it makes sense as you're going back and laying this whole thing out. Now, are you working on a sequel, I understand?
I will be, but not in the near future, because I learned last year that the FBI had not sent me all of their files. They found a whole other batch of files numbering in the 300 to 400 pages. I didn't get half that much the first time around. But they will not be sent to me for another 2 years because they have a long waiting list and it was a lot of work to compile. But I know when those come in 2 years from now, I am not done with the Richard Speck case. I'm going to probably do a sequel and, just impatient to receive them, but I know I have more left to tell about this story.
Well, we are anxious to hear it as well. And just to sort of tie up this end of it, Richard Speck was sentenced to what? And he's no longer with us. He had a heart attack.
He was sentenced to die in the electric chair, but the state of Illinois overturned that, much as they did in California with Manson and how they have done in other states with other mass murderers. He was then sentenced to serve between 400 and 1,200 years in prison. Pretty much a life sentence and many life sentences. And he served 25 years and died in prison in 1991. It was the day before he was to turn 50. And so he's a goner. Almost, as I said, almost all the participants are gone. And it's like I said, it's not a case people are going to open up and look at. And that, as I said, was inspiring me to do so because it's not a closed case. It is the tip of a very deep iceberg.
Well, it certainly is. It is not closed. And once you read this book, and again, reading a review, so many people have thought it was a closed case. I'll look at this. I remember the case. And suddenly they're caught up in it and going, wait a minute, I think there was a rush to judgment here. I don't think that this guy was the one who committed the crimes. The book is Richard Speck and the Eight Nurses, Deconstructing a Mass Murder by B.D. Salerno. That's S-A-L-E-R-N-O. Book available Amazon, wherever books are sold. B.D.'s website is strangebuttruecrime.com. You can follow that, the other books that she has written. You'll find out when the sequel will be coming out in several years, a fascinating follow-up to this book. B.D., it is always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us again. We'll have to do this and not wait 10 years to do it again, 8 or 10 years. We'll have to do something sooner, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about the sequel when it's available. Thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to be back.
It is a pleasure to have you back with us, B.D. Salerno. The book is Richard Speck and the Eight Nurses, Deconstructing a Mass Murder. Her website is strangebuttruecrime.com. You can click on that directly by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. And we're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.